Available now from Graphic Audio.
Do you know what they're calling one of their leaders?
Who, God voice?
The Togairu Rebels. One band of raiders has named their leader Ashwarawu. Do you know what that means? He who kills without mercy.
Our enemy is a Ru called Ashwarawu.
A mighty leader?
A coward who strikes at the vulnerable and retreats to the shadows. But of late, he grows bolder, and his attacks come nearer and nearer to Daryan.
I will line the steps with the heads of Chazolei dog warriors.
You cannot fight a war alone. You have heard of Ashwarawu?
Ashwarawu gathers warriors as he roams from village to village. The baronies fear him.
We know where he is. Or we know at least where you can go to be found.
Ashwarawu.
You are far from any village, woman.
I am where I'm meant to be.
Who are you, and why have you come?
I am Bryn Dariel. I have no home, and I was a wanderer until very recently when I happened upon a village controlled by a despised Yatol. I killed the Yatol and his Chezolei lackey beside him. And so again, I have no home.
Then you are welcome as one of my warriors.
How did you find us?
Perhaps you are not as well hidden as you believe.
How he found us is not as important as why he found us. What do the Shistatu see in our struggles that would so interest you, Mystic?
I have come to Togai to learn.
What is there to learn, Mystic? How to fight? How to die?
Perhaps how to live.
Kill all of them! Charge!
Ashwarawu!
Don't miss the cataclysmic action in part 2 of the Demon Wars Saga Book 6, Transcendence. Available now in Graphic Audio.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents William W. Johnstone's Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man 17, Ordeal of the Mountain Man. Narrated by Mort Shelby. With performances by James Lewis, Karen Carbone, Elizabeth Jernigan, Laura Quinn Anderson, Nanette Savard, Tim Getter, Joe Bratt, Tony Penn, Ken Jackson, Andy Clements, Terrence Acer, David Coyne, Eric Mesner, Michael Glenn, James Konachek, Christopher Graybill, and Dylan Lynch. Smoke Jensen, The Mountain Man 17, Ordeal of the Mountain Man.
Dust rose like a brown shroud around the rumps of a long string of shiny-coated horses as they trotted, tails high, away from the lush pastures of Sugarloaf, Smoke Jensen's ranch. Smoke and a dozen hands, including Utah Jack Grubbs, Jerry Harkness, and Luke Britton, had set out to drive a herd of 200 remounts north to Fort Custer on the Crow Indian Reservation in Montana. It would turn out to be a much longer and harder journey than Smoke would have believed, becoming a grueling ordeal for Jensen and every man with him. At the lower pasture fence, Sally and young Bobby Jensen sat their mounts and waved at the departing backs. Sally thought uneasily of the many times Smoke had ridden away on far more dangerous missions. Over the nearly 10 years they had been married, after Smoke's first wife and son were brutally murdered, Smoke had strapped on 6 guns and frequently a badge, gone off to right the wrongs done to himself or more often to others, even strangers. Smoke didn't see himself as any sort of Robin Hood, though he had read the legends as a youth, learning from the old mountain man preacher what he had abandoned when he strayed from his parents' wagon as a half-grown child. Family had been bound for the Northwest Territory when he got lost in the wilderness. Sally had first seen Smoke Jensen as a ruffian, a barbarian, and a gunfighter. She was teaching school at the time. Smoke came to town and cleaned out a gang of gun trash and saddle tramps, leaving a wide wake of bodies along the way. At first, his bloodthirsty conduct disgusted and frightened her. But she had soon learned better when he rescued her from the clutches of the gang boss. After that, she knew him as a tall, handsome man with longish reddish-brown hair and a ready smile. Now, she brushed aside such reflections and thought about the three hands who rode with him. Jerry Harkness had been with Smoke ever since he changed from cattle ranching to raising blooded horses. Jerry knew more about horses and their ailments than most veterinarians. He had grown up on a thoroughbred farm in Kentucky. Lean and tall, Jerry was in his mid-20s with the bowed legs of a jockey, his muscles bunched and corded. As their cook, Zeke Thackeray, put it, he was smack-bang loyal. Jerry rode for the brand and would die for it if need be. Another cut from the same mold was Luke Britton. A year or two younger than Jerry, he was an easygoing, even-tempered young man with a high school education, which was an exception for the times. Barrel-chested and broad-shouldered, he was frequently mistaken for a bare-knuckle boxer, which he wasn't, but he could hold his own, much to the regret of many a proddy drifter who challenged him. Luke was a man to ride the river with. Jack Grubbs was a short, bow-legged, salty horse expert with a checkered past. When the Sugarloaf foreman had interviewed him only 3 months earlier, he had been troubled enough by what he learned to turn Jack over to Smoke the question. Later, after he had hired Grubbs, Smoke told Sally that Jack had been in prison. Streak of wildness in his youth, Utah Jack had explained, which he had outgrown. Recalling his own past, Smoke had said that all Jack needed was a chance to redeem himself. For some reason, that now came back to give Sally a cold shiver along her spine. But she shook it off and turned to their adopted son.
Come on, Bobby. We might as well ride back to the house. We won't see them for 2 months.
I'm gonna miss Smoke awfully. I hope nothing happens to him.
With Luke and Utah Jack on swing and Pop Walker on drag, Smoke Jensen rode at the front of the trail herd with Jerry Harkness. They headed for Wyoming in a lighthearted mood. Jerry cracked a constant string of engine and politician jokes.
You hear the one about the politician who went out to explain to the Sioux chiefs about the new treaty? He got out here with an interpreter who translated his words. After each sentence had been put into Lakota, the chiefs would grunt and say, "Unke." Now, he told them how they would be restricted to reservations from now on, and again they said, "Unke." So this goes on until the end, when the chiefs all tapped their open palms with their eagle wing fans and shouted it 3 times. Then one chief got up and made a short speech. The interpreter told the politician that the chiefs thanked him for his good words and wanted to know if he wished to see some of Sioux life. The politician said that yes, he did. He'd always wanted to see a buffalo hunt. It was arranged, and hunters rode out to find the bison while the chiefs and the politician started walking out on the prairie where the buffalo roamed. Now, all of a sudden, the interpreter reached out and grabbed the politician's arm and stopped him from stepping in a big pile of buffalo bull plop and said, "Be careful not to step in the yunke."
Jerry, don't you have anything better to amuse yourself?
Oh, sure. Do you hear about the Indian, the settler, and the politician who all died and wound up beside the pearly gates?
Spare me.
Four days later, 6 pairs of eyes watched while the herd crossed the border from Colorado into the Wyoming Territory. One of the men in the small party, Yancey Osborne, turned to the others.
That's them, all right. Burke, you ride north and let Hub Volker know they're on the way.
What are the rest of you gonna do?
We'll follow along, then back reports on their movement.
Good enough. I'll tell Mr. Volker that. Burke walked his horse away from his companions in order not to draw the attention of the drovers. Once out of earshot, Yancey turned to the others with a nasty grin.
Well, boys, now that we got Mr. Rule Book out of our hair, got me an idea how to pass our time while those nags move north. I know a nice little stagecoach we can rob.
50 miles northwest, Owen Curtis sat in his saddle, his left leg cocked up around the pommel, eyes fixed on the brown humps of his prized Herefords. He had paid a pretty penny for the first bull and three cows that formed the base of his herd. Over the years, he had added new blood and his stock increased by nature's decree. Although the bevy was still small, Owen modestly counted himself as a rich man. By the lights of many who struggled against the hostilities of Wyoming Territory, the severe winter weather, summer drought, and of course always the Indians, Curtis was indeed a wealthy, successful man. The rumble of distant hooves drew his attention to the head of the grazing beasts. Three of his hands kept him in a loose gather, allowing him to move slowly through the grassy meadow eating their fill, while subtly leading him toward water. Seven riders appeared abruptly over the ridge of the basin, riding hard toward the cattle. Owen Curtis looked on helpless, stunned by the sight, as puffs of white smoke blossomed from the muzzles of the rifles the intruders held to their shoulders. Two of his men went down as Owen swung his leg into the stirrup and slid his Winchester from its scabbard. A half dozen more rustlers jolted down the side slope to the bowl-like pasture and began to turn the cattle back on their frightened fellows. Curtis took aim. He aimed at another target. The only problem was that he had attracted the attention of the thieves. Three cut their horses in his direction and bore down on the rancher. One of them raised their pistol. A bright, hot pain erupted in Curtis Owen's chest. Immediately, Hubble Volker turned to his men.
Get these snuffles under control and take them out of here!
Where to, Mr. Volker?
Take them up to Bedrock Canyon, Darth. There's plenty of pines up there to build a holding corral.
You mean work? Get blisters on her hands?
Ain't what you had in mind when you joined the Reno Gym Gang, is it? Well, when you're counting your share of the take, you'll forget the broke blisters and sore muscles. Hey, get them under control! Head them up and slow them down!
With an anticipatory twinkle in his eye, Yancey Osborne watched the steady approach of the stage to Laramie. The heads of the six-up team bobbed rhythmically, and their powerful shoulders churned to draw the heavily laden vehicle forward. It had taken Osborne and his cohorts a day's ride to get in position. Yancey figured the herd of remounts would stay to the main trail, there being plenty of Indians roaming out there if they didn't. Now, they were about to relieve the Wells Fargo Company of a good deal of loot. Osborne made curt gestures, directing his men to position. He and Smiling Dave Winters remained in the center of the road, a fleshy barricade. The coach disappeared into a dip, and each of the outlaws raised a bandana to cover his face. Weapons at the ready, they waited for the stage to reappear a scant 30 yards from them. The heads of the lead pair surged above the draw and gained the level. Quickly, the rest appeared, and Yancey made out the driver and shotgun guard. He raised his Winchester. With only a six-gun for defense, the grizzled teamster hauled on the reins and applied the brake. Immediately, the masked outlaws moved in. Ansel Wharton had driven stages for Wells Fargo for 9 years. In that time, he'd been robbed 11 times. He knew exactly what to do when he saw the masked bandits strung out along the road and blocking it ahead, especially when the shotgun guard jolted backward and toppled over the side of the driver's seat.
Afternoon. We'll relieve you of that strong box, if you please.
What if I told you we don't have one?
Then your wife would be a widow.
I ain't got a wife. She died the cholera back a ways. Now let me see, was it in 64 or 72?
Quit stalling and hand it over.
I'd be obliged if you let me step down and you had a couple of your friends remove it. It's a heavy sucker this trip.
Mighty nice to hear. Good enough, old man. Climb on down. Mind, keep your hand clear of that hog leg you're packing.
Oh, I've been robbed before, and I know what to do. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here.
There's some of you do learn, I do declare.
The jovial bandit, Ansel named him mentally. He'd remember the voice and the size. This one was a brute, a huge bruiser with broad shoulders, a hefty girth, thick arms and wrists. Looked like he could take on 3 men at once and not raise a sweat. Ansel worked his way down the small, round, cast-iron mountain steps and walked to the headstall of the lead horse.
Keep him from spooking, don't you see?
Now there's a smart man. Good idea. Keep him calm while we relieve you of everything else and ask the passengers for a contribution.
There ain't but one strong box, and Cheney's got it.
Ansel carefully omitted the shipment of gold bars under the backward-facing bench seat inside.
All right, everybody out of the coach. We forgot to bring any fancy steps, so we'll have to jump down.
In short time, the passengers had been relieved of their valuables and herded back inside the vehicle. Osborne set 2 men to unharness in the horses. Before they left, the outlaws scattered the team. Galloping off with their considerable loot, gold undiscovered, they cast not a glance at the stranded occupants of the stage. Reno Jim Urien looked down from a long slope that formed one wall of a box gorge known as Bent Rock Canyon. A satisfied smile formed under the pencil-thin black mustache that adorned his thin upper lip. Not a sign of the stolen cattle could be seen. His flat gray eyes took on an inner glow.
We can keep them here until we have the horses as well, then take them all in to sell. There's a livestock broker I know who doesn't look too close at the brands.
You mean your partner, Mr. Kelp?
At an upraised hand from Jim Urien, the not-too-bright Hubble Volker cut off his words before saying the name. Always the dapper dresser, Reno Jim preferred red silk-lined black morning coats with matching trousers, brocaded vests, and frilly white shirts with spills of lace at front, collar, and cuff. He adjusted the latter now as he stared down at his talkative second-in-command from under the wide brim of the flat-crowned black Stetson he habitually wore cocked at a rakish angle.
Never mind who. The point is, he will be buying anything we bring him. I want you to take over here for now and wait for word on the horses. I'm going on up to Muddy Gap to see that everything is ready for their arrival.
A thin white spiral of smoke came from the chimney of the Iron Kettle, the best eatery in Muddy Gap, Wyoming territory. That it was the only public eating house in town, outside the hotel, the proud city fathers preferred not to acknowledge. Along the ambitiously wide Main Street, several prosperous business establishments had hung out their shingles. The raw wooden sidewalls and fresh paint of the building facades testified to the newness of this thriving community. Among them were Harbinson's General Mercantile, the Territorial Bank of Muddy Gap, the only stone building in town, Walker's Saddlery, Hope's Apothecary and Sundries, Thelma Blackman's Ladies' Fashions, Ty Meyer's Butcher's Shop, a blacksmith, the feed and grain store, and 4 saloons. At the north end of town stood a small white clapboard church. To the south, an equally minuscule schoolhouse. Inside the school, class had been in session since 8 that morning. The younger students, with the shorter attention spans, had become restless, eager for recess. The older grades, 3 through 8, laboriously attacked their assignments. Virginia Parkins, the school teacher, was listening to the 6th grade read aloud when the door slammed open against the inner wall and 3 large, loudish youths swaggered inside. Although she had 2 14-year-olds and 1 15 in the 7th and 8th grades, Virginia recognized these ruffians as being considerably older, the youngest not under 16. She looked on them with a frown of irritation. With expressions of blended contempt and disgust, The bullies strutted up the aisle and stopped beside the desk of young James Finch. One of them, a pig-faced boy named Brandon Kelso, spoke from the advantage of his height.
Get out of that desk, Jimmy! You ain't got no business wasting your time here.
I've got to read next.
What's that?
Brandon reached down with a large hand and yanked the slight, big-eyed boy out of his desk.
Your daddy needs you to help work stock. Now get your butt out of this dump and do as you're told.
Thoroughly frightened, the small boy started moving his feet before Brandon Kelso lowered him to the floor.
Enough of your crude vulgarities, Brandon Kelso. You and these other louts need your mouths washed out with soap. Now, leave the children alone and get out of my classroom.
Brandon took a cocky step toward her.
Who's gonna make us, teacher?
Fat, porcine lips curled in contempt, Brandon Kelso studied the outraged young woman before him. He figured she might make a good poke, although he did lack any experience in such encounters. Couldn't be much older than himself. Those green eyes and the auburn hair, her wide, pouty-looking mouth, they made his groin swell and ache just looking at her. He'd never thought she'd had any fire in her. He'd quit school 4 years ago before she had come here. He got tired of doing the sixth grade a third time at the age of 13. Now, had she been here then, he might not have quit. She would have given him something to fill his, mind with when he was sitting in the outhouse. He made kissing motions with his lips. Her unexpected reaction surprised him. Virginia turned sharply away and walked directly to one corner by the blackboard. She came back with a stout willow switch about 4 feet long. Virginia hustled all three out onto the low stoop and hurried them down the steps. From the safety of the schoolyard, Brandon Kelso turned back.
You know my father's on the school board. If you want to keep your job, you better watch what you do to me and my friends.
I'll risk that. Now get, and don't come back.
That task completed, she returned to the schoolroom.
You may return to your desk, Jimmy. You will read next.
Riding his handsome chestnut roan thoroughbred stallion down the center of the main street of Muddy Gap, Reno Jim Urian sat tall in the saddle. He looked neither left nor right. A light hand on the reins, he guided Walker's Kentucky Pride toward the tie rail in front of the Territorial Bank of Muddy Gap. There, the well-mannered horse stopped primly on a dime and waited without even an ear twitch while Jim Urian dismounted. He looped the reins over the crossbar and removed his black leather gloves. Reno Jim used them to flick the spots of trail dust from his trouser legs and the sleeves of his immaculate swallowtail morning coat. Then he stepped regally up onto the boardwalk. Without a glance in the direction of the bank lobby, he walked to an extension of the plank sidewalk that ran along one side of the building into an alley. At its end, he began to ascend a flight of steps that ended on a small platform outside a door that gave access to the second floor. Halfway down the well-scrubbed and highly polished hall, he paused a moment before the frosted glass pane that occupied the upper half of a closed door. He reached out and turned the knob. He shouldered past the gilt-edged letters that spelled out in boldface, Boyne Kelso, grain and livestock broker.
I have good news, Boyne. That herd of remounts on their way to Fort Custer will soon be ours.
They really exist, then?
Yes. Some of my men watched them cross over from Colorado. Just short of 3 weeks, they should be on the Crow Reservation. That is, they would be, if we didn't have other plans for them.
Excellent, excellent. Well, this calls for a mild celebration. I recommend the saloon bar in the Wilbur House Hotel. They pour a fine bourbon.
Well, that sounds fine to me.
Together, the two men left the office and strode out onto the main boardwalk. Every man who passed respectfully touched the brim of his hat in salute to Boyne Kelso. A woman in a wide, gray, voluminous dress and wide-edged bonnet of the same material nodded politely.
Afternoon, Deacon Kelso.
Good afternoon, Amanda.
Reno Jim smiled behind his hand. He knew that Kelso, born to a Protestant family in the north of Ireland, was considered a pillar of the community. Throughout Wyoming territory, his rectitude was legend. Nobody questioned his scales or the quality of seed grain he sold. Considered a loving husband and father, with charming, well-mannered children, Kelso was frequently held up as a paragon of societal excellence. What would those fine, well-meaning people think if they knew the truth of Kelso's nature? Most likely, Reno Jim mused, they would fill their fancy drawers. Well, they needed those well-intentioned souls. Without them, they could never survive in the business of robbing and rustling. Nor could they profit any longer from the land swindles handled by their trusty underlings in the land office. When the good folk lost their meekness, terrible things happened. He shivered when he recalled what had occurred recently in Cripple Creek. Somehow, the good people of that area had found out they were being bilked, cheated, robbed, and even murdered by minions in the employ of Reno Jim Urien. They had organized a vigilance committee. He suppressed a shudder as he visualized 11 of his best men dangling from ropes over the limbs of brooding oak trees. So much gruesome fruit. And his own ignominious route from Cripple Creek, tarred, feathered, and slung over a pole. Reno Jim quickly banished the horrible visions as they reached the hotel. Inside, seated at a rich cherry wood table, Reno Jim eyed the softly glowing brass lamps and fittings, the dark, lustrous sheen of the mahogany bar, the muted nature of the flocked red velvet wallpaper. He sighed in contentment. This was the sort of world he preferred to live in. A coatless bartender in sleeve garters and a blue pinstripe collarless shirt brought him a crystal decanter of premium bourbon and two matching glasses.
How soon will your men be coming here?
Sometime next week. Certainly before the horses get here. I want to take them farther north.
Good. I'll be busy over the weekend with the church council.
You had better keep your nose clean if you want to hold on to that fine reputation. But your plans are no problem. I'll also be busy over the weekend.
They talked on for a while. During their third glass of the smoothest, sweetest bourbon Jim Reno had ever tasted, a sudden commotion rose in the street outside. They shouldered their way through the room and out the bat wings into the lobby. A crowd had gathered in front of the Big Horn and Laramie stage line office by the time Boyne Kelso and Reno Jim Urien reached there.
How many of them was it, Hansel?
Reckon there was 9 to 10 of them.
How much did they get, Sam? The bank had a shipment on there, you know.
Didn't touch that. Never mind, Mr. Kelso. That's between the company and the bank. What's got me riled is that they killed Roop.
Oh, that's an outrage. I certainly hope your company has enough compassion to arrange for some church ladies to go along when his widow is given the news. And I say now that these depredations must cease. To that end, I'm offering a reward of $500, dead or alive, for those responsible. Any idea who, Sam?
Nope. They all wore masks. Didn't give me a name. Like that Black Bart fella out in California a while back. Just took the money and these folks' valuables and rode off. We'd have been in sooner if they hadn't chased off our horses.
Oh, this is deplorable. We cannot tolerate this any longer. Where's the sheriff? Why hasn't he sent out a posse?
With that, Kelso turned away and stalked toward the sheriff's office. Hiding his grin, Reno Jim Urien went the opposite way to retrieve his horse from in front of the bank. In 10 minutes, he rode clear of town, headed to meet his gang, and see what new profit he had gained in the holdup. Across a dividing ridge, Smoke Jensen decided that the time was right to take care of what had been bothering him for the past day and a half. He reined in and motioned Jerry Harkness to take the herd on. He sat his new Palouse stallion, Cougar, while the remounts legged their way past. His face set in concentration. Smoke seemed not to notice the dust that boiled up. When Luke Britton, riding drag today, ambled by, Smoke gave him a light wave and dropped back down their trail. Near the crest of the ridge, he angled into a craggy gorge and reined up. 5 minutes later, three seedy-looking characters, whom Smoke had seen several times trailing them, walked their mounts into view.
I think it's time you fellas stopped trailing us.
Who says?
I do.
Well, that don't cut no slack with me.
Then I'll give you a choice. You can turn around and light a shuck out of here. You can tell me why you're following us.
What if I said we was looking for the higher own?
Then I'd have to call you a liar.
That does it, by God! That surely does it! Draw!
By then, the two others had unlimbered their revolvers and now attempted to bring them up in line with this unnervingly fast stranger. They failed miserably in the attempt.
Oh! My arm.
His companion thought better of further aggression. He turned his horse, spurred it into a gallop, and sprinted for the top of the rise. As he disappeared over the crest, Smoke Jensen walked Cougar over close to the wounded man.
Now tell me, who are you riding for?
We ain't working for nobody. We only figured to cut out a few head and make a little money off of them. That's all, mister.
Why is it I don't believe you? Well, in the event you all of a sudden remember who it is, you can tell him the reason you got shot up is that you ran into Smoke Jensen.
Oh, Jesus.
He can't help you. You ride out of here while I pick up that six gun. We got a herd to deliver.
On a hillside overlooking the town, Hubble Volker sat his mount at the center of a crescent formed by the Urian gang. Together, they gazed down on the scene of domesticity. Volker waved a hand in the direction of Muddy Gap.
We'll give him a little more time. Let the shops open up, bank. Then we make our move. Too bad the boss couldn't come along. He'd have enjoyed this.
I smell biscuits baking. Sure could use some of them.
Well, Harry Joe, maybe you can help yourself to some when we clean out the town.
But I'm hungry now. What are we gonna eat?
Air, if you didn't bring something along. Me, I got me some cornbread from last night and some fried fatback. Sure gonna taste good. You got a plan ahead, Harry Joe?
At least let me have shared in some of that, Hub.
Nope. Ain't got enough. Ask the other boys. They only brung enough for themselves, too.
No.
2 hours later, the main street began to bustle with merchants and their employees. Doors opened and shades went up. A few early customers rolled into town on buckboards or on horseback. Hubble Volker looked on, weighing the right time. It would not be long. That much he knew for sure. Riding in twos, as directed by Urian's second-in-command, the gang entered the main street of Muddy Gap from different directions. Each pair went to an assigned business front. Hub Volker and Garth Evans entered the bank. One teller looked up and peered at him from under a green eye shade, a welcome smile already forming on his lips. Then he saw the weapons in their hands and the masks over their faces.
Oh, my God!
That's right, folks. This is a holdup. Everybody put your hands over your heads. You tellers, fill money bags with everything in your tills. You, Mr. Banker, you be so kind as to step over to the vault and empty it out.
You can't get away with this. The marshal will come running and the sheriff is back in town. I'll not help you steal from these good people.
In that case, we don't have any more use for you.
Volker shoved through the swinging gate that divided the lobby from the working end of the bank and yanked a bug-eyed clerk from his desk. He shoved him toward the big safe.
You'll do. Get busy stuffing these bags with money.
We better work fast, boss. Those shots are sure to bring the law.
Good. Then we won't have to waste time hunting them down.
From the General Mercantile came the crash of disturbed galvanized washtubs and buckets. Moments later, two masked men swaggered out onto the street. One clutched a fat cloth bag. Behind him, the proprietor appeared in the doorway, a shotgun in his hands. Swiftly, he brought the weapon to his shoulder. Most of the shot tore into the cloth sack. It erupted in shreds. Coin and paper currency flew in all directions. Three of the gang, left to cover the street, turned their revolvers on the storekeeper. Most of the nasty work had been done by then. Two-thirds of the Urian gang had gathered in the middle of the block, ready to ride out. At last, Hub and his cohort stepped out of the bank, arms filled with canvas money satchels.
All right, boys, mount up!
Belatedly, the law showed up in the person of Sheriff Hutchins and two deputies. Hub slung the drawstrings of his money pouches over his saddle horn and turned to respond. He filled his hand with the Merwin and Holbert. The sheriff took cover behind a rain barrel and fired around one side. Gunderson, chubby outlaw originally from Norway, clutched his belly.
Get my hand getting mounted. We gotta get out of here.
In the next instant, Hub Volker saw his chance and raised the Merwin and Holbert to sighting position. He watched in satisfaction as the bullet struck the sheriff full in the mouth. A spray of blood, bone, hair, and tissue erupted from the back of the lawman's head. By then, the shock had worn off some of the townsmen. A new crackle of gunfire rippled down the street. One of those offering resistance was the mayor, Lester Norton. Determined to contain him until the law and volunteers could act, he alternately fired and then ducked from obstruction to obstruction as he steadily advanced on the gang. He was in mid-stride when a bullet fired by Evans smashed into his right shoulder and knocked the Winchester from his hand. Wisely, he went down and played dead. The gang had had enough. Ducking low, the final few swung into their saddles. Firing wildly now, the outlaws put spurs to their horses and thundered along the main street while citizens ducked and shot blindly back. Only a scatter of stray shots pursued them. In a minute, except for a thin dust cloud, nothing marked their presence at all. In the aftermath, while the wounded received care and the dead were carried off to the undertaken and used furniture parlor, Boyne Kelso sought out Mayor Norton. He found the mayor being patched up by Doc Voight outside Harbinson's General Mercantile. Arranging his features into his best expression of concern and outrage, he took the mayor aside to the saloon bar of the hotel.
Lester, I am deeply concerned by this. Why, only a handful of volunteers went out as a posse, led by our least experienced deputy. The sheriff is dead, and Grover Larson is cowering at home, afraid the outlaws will come back. What I said about the stage robbery only last Friday goes double for this assault on our very homes.
You mean you put up $1,000 reward?
Yes, of course. $2,000 if that's what it takes. I've talked to Ralph at the bank. He's president now, I suppose. They'll put up money for the reward also. Eb Harbison is still picking up cartwheels and gold eagles, but he offered $100. Got most of his back, even if they did kill his father. But the point is not that.
What is it?
What is most important is that we must reinforce the law in this town. We have to find a replacement for Walt Hutchins immediately. We both know that Larson is too old for this job. He's slow, and the sound of gunfire frightens him. He needs to be replaced as well as the sheriff. Believe me, until we do, this town is terribly vulnerable.
Since early morning, it had been building. Smoke Jensen kept a watchful eye on the towering clouds to the southwest. Slowly, they progressed across the eastern downslopes of the Rocky Mountains and spread out across the high plains country. The storm had all the looks of a vicious, straight-line squall. Among land-borne storms, such a phenomenon ranked second only to a tornado in ferocity. Smoke had encountered only four in all his years in the High Lonesome. The manes and tails of their horses dropped abruptly, then picked up as a stronger breeze from a slightly different quarter came in. Smoke frowned and again cut his eyes to the dust cloud. What he saw decided him to ride ahead a ways and look for a sheltered gully or basin where they could hold the remounts and wait out the storm. His search proved harder than he had expected. 2 miles ahead, he found a ravine that was too small. Determined, he rode on. Cougar began to sense the change in the atmosphere. Another mile went by without any likely spot. Smoke had about decided to turn back after covering what he estimated to be a half a mile more. Then he saw it. Sunlight cast stark shadows over a cut in a hill. A fold eroded into the rising mound lay behind. The high side of the bluff lay between the direction of the storm and the small closed valley that was formed by rushing water in ancient days. At once, he turned back to lead the horses there.
There's shelter ahead that we can use.
Smoke spoke to Harkness when he returned to the gather of animals. He cast a precautionary gaze at the approaching storm.
If we have time, that is.
Over the next hour, that dingy brown mass swirling in the air extended upward and out over the drovers as they worked Smoke's horses toward the sheltered valley. Uprooted sagebrush bounded along the ground. Small dust devils formed and raised dirt, leaves, and pebbles into the air, only to dissipate and spew out their contents across the faces of the men and the coats of their mounts. Steadily, the force increased. Invisible hands tugged at the sheepskin coat Smoke Jensen had shrugged into when the temperature had dropped drastically. Caught in the strobing effect, the legs of the half-broken horses went all akimbo. For a second, they appeared to skid in place. Then, they broke out in every direction. Panic reigned as the straight-line cyclonic storm slammed into them. Rapidly, the remounts ran before the punishing tumult. At once, the men went after them. With only a third of the 200 horses headed into the little valley, the hands had no choice but to pursue. Battered by rain blown nearly horizontal, the Sugarloaf riders streamed helplessly after the frightened critters. Slowly, Smoke and his men had to give up, knowing that they would have an even harder time recovering the animals after the storm had blown beyond them. Together, they sought shelter in the valley along with Smoke. Above their heads, the sky turned an ominous black. In half an hour, the trail and edge of the storm spattered itself out on the leaves of cottonwoods that ringed the valley. With Caleb Noonan left behind to watch over the 60 horses that had not fled the storm, the rest set out the search for the scattered remounts.
We'll spread out and work in circles. Bring them back as you find them.
After a fruitless afternoon of search, Smoke had a flash of inspiration. While the others speared chunks of fatbacks from tin plates and chewed glumly, Smoke outlined his idea.
Tomorrow morning, we're going to try it another way. Luke, I want you to go back to the valley after you eat. Bring up a couple of mares. It will be best if you can bag at least one that's in season.
Grinning riders cut their eyes from Smoke to one another in knowing glances. As long as the wind held from the southwest, that would sure as shooting work. Smoke came to his boots and went to the nearby stream to scrub his plate clean with sand. Luke Britton left with a good 2 hours' light remaining. He considered himself lucky to find one mare in heat. He brought back 3 others, and wily horse experts Jerry Harkness and Utah Jack Grubbs offered advice on how to make the most advantage of this. What they came up with required a rather indelicate procedure involving some old cheesecloth from a side of bacon and a bit of messy work around the tail of each mare. When they had finished, Smoke sent the dozen men out in groups of 3. Within half an hour, Jerry Harkness rode in with a dozen snorting, skittering young stallions in tow, led by ropes around their necks. He gave Smoke a cheery wave.
It worked all right. What do we do with them now?
I'll hold them here. Go on back and find me some more. Jerry, you did good. Any more on the way?
Sure enough. Jeff is about 20 minutes behind me. He has a string of 20.
At this rate, we might be on the trail again by this time tomorrow.
Reunited with his gang, Reno Jim Urien led him up the lane to the Olson Ranch. When they reached the barnyard, they spread out and advanced on the house. Reno Jim raised his hat with his left hand, his right hand on the pearl grip of his six gun.
Hello, the house. Your best chance is to come out and not show any fight. Otherwise, someone is gonna get hurt.
In answer, a rifle barrel slid through a firing loop in a thick wooden shutter that had been hastily closed.
Get off this place, mister, or it'll be you who's hurting.
It was a young voice. A boy not yet out of his teens, Jim Urien correctly surmised. He had never met Elmer Godwin, yet he could clearly visualize him. Scrawny, scared out of his boots, perhaps his father gone for the day. His hand shaking so much he could not draw a good bead. With exaggerated slowness, Reno Jim drew his nickel-plated Merwin and Hulbert 44 and pointed it roughly in the direction of the window.
You've had your warning, boy. Now you and everyone else, come out of there!
You can go to hell!
At once, the other outlaws began to blaze away. A tight circle of hard cases blew apart. Gunmen spun their mounts while others rode out to ring the house. Those who had turned saw a stocky man kneeling in the doorway of the barn, a rifle to his shoulder. Three of them threw shots at him, but all missed. Sven Olsen didn't. Half a dozen more bullets crashed into the barn door. Two of them struck Sven Olsen in the chest and abdomen. A rain of slugs battered the Olsen house. Chunks of wood splintered away the shutter, and the rifle barrel withdrew, only to reappear at another window. Impatient at this stubborn resistance, Reno Jim dismounted and gestured to three others to join him. They ran to the porch where they were in under the field of fire from the window.
Here we go, boys.
Reno Jim kicked open the door. Two outlaws, followed by Reno Jim, burst into the room. They caught movement to one side and swung their hot-barreled six guns toward it. Reno Jim proved faster than any of his men. Coolly, he raised his 44 Merwin and Hulbert and shot Elmer Godwin through one lung in his heart.
Go!
All right. Clear out anything of value and then set this place afire.
Out on the porch, he called to the remainder of the gang.
You boys round up all the stock and head them up. We'll drive them to Bedrock Canyon with the rest.
Two days after the raid on the Olsen Ranch, Smoke Jensen and his hands rode into Muddy Gap. At first, he didn't understand the furtive, nervous, and downright suspicious glances afforded him by the residents. They got a clearer idea when they began to note bullet holes and scars on the building fronts, and above the town, on a knoll not yet fenced, consecrated for that purpose, fresh graves in what would be the town cemetery. Smoke Jensen passed on his observation to Utah Jack Grubbs.
Looks like these folks have run into some trouble of late.
Indians, do you think?
From the looks of all the bullet holes and the scared way the folks have been looking at us, I'd say white men. Outlaws from one gang or another.
Surely they have some law in this town. That the place ain't shot up worse than it is, I'd say whoever it was, they got run out real fast.
You may be right, Utah. We'll find out soon enough.
Smoke nodded ahead in the street to where a half a dozen armed men stood resolutely, weapons at the ready. They formed a wedge that denied passage to anyone not at a full gallop. At the head stood a man with bandaged right shoulder. When Smoke in his hands came within 20 feet, that man raised his arm to signal a halt.
That's far enough, strangers. Who are you? And what's your business in Muddy Gap?
Looks like you had some trouble here lately.
And how do we know you're not the ones who caused it? Besides, you haven't answered my question.
My fault. My name's Jensen. I'm from the Sugarloaf Horse Ranch in Colorado. These are some of my hands. We're driving a herd of remounts to Fort Custer.
You're going on a Crow reservation with only four men?
Nope. The rest of us are holding the herd outside town.
Jensen, you say? Might you be any relation to a fella named Smoke Jensen?
I might be and am. Folks have called me Smoke for a long time.
Mayor Lester Norton. My pleasure. It's said that you've been a lawman for many years now. A U.S. Marshal?
Deputy, yes.
Are you still carrying a badge, Mr. Jensen?
Not at the moment.
I'd be obliged if you'd accompany me to the Iron Kettle, Mr. Jensen. There's something important I want to discuss with you over a cup of coffee.
Fine with me. We came in for supplies. That won't take a lot of time. You boys might as well come along. Load up on some real grub for once.
Walking their horses to a tie rail, the Sugarloaf party went with the mayor to the corner cafe. Once inside, Jerry and the other hands took a separate table. Smoke seated himself across from Mayor Norton. His gaze took in the blue, checkered, lace-trimmed curtains at the window, the row of shiny copper molds on a shelf above the back counter, and a sturdy pot-belly stove at the center of the rear wall. A serving window under the shelf gave a view of the kitchen beyond. A still-trim woman who might have been in her early 30s brought him coffee without being told.
Well, we're in trouble here. Over the 5 days since those outlaws raided town, half the riffraff in the territory have drifted into town. It wouldn't take much of a spark or a whole lot of smarts on the part of some to make a move to take over the town. We need you, or someone like you, to clean the trash out of Muddy Gap.
Well, why not have the sheriff take care of it?
Sheriff Hutchins was killed by the bandits. We buried him 2 days ago up on the hill out there.
You have a town marshal, don't you?
Marshal Grover Larson is too busy hiding under his bed to help us against this glut of ne'er-do-wells.
But why me? I have a herd of horses to take care of. I have a contract and a deadline to meet.
First off, because I heard that you're a fair and honest man. A top-notch lawman, regardless of the wanted posters and what they say. Secondly, you've acquired some notoriety as a gunfighter. Third, because you're here. We don't waste time we may not have sending for somebody. And lastly, because the town can pay handsomely for your services. Can't your hands take care of the horses for a while, even a few days? Surely you can clean them out in less than a week.
I could, given some help.
Then you'll undertake to do it?
I'm sorry, Mr. Mayor. I'm not your man. We can't be late at Fort Custer, or the army won't pay for our horses.
Smoke Jensen started for the door. That was the voice of a woman.
Ah, damn.
After brooding for a week over his humiliation by that snotty twist of a schoolmarm, Brandon Kelso saw the opportunity to gain his revenge. In the aftermath of the bandit raid on Muddy Gap, as more and more frontier trash moseyed into town, the thought came that he and his friends could get away with just about anything. Sheriff Hutchins was dead, his deputies out on the trail of the gang that had robbed every store in town, and Marshal Larson had taken to bed, complaining of a terrible gripe. His chance came unexpectedly on the day Smoke Jensen rode into town. It being a Saturday, Prissy Missy Parkins had no duties around the school. Instead, she had come out of her small house and walked to the center of town to purchase the needs for the week to come. She entered Blackman's Ladies' Fashions first. Brandon quickly summoned the two willing accomplices. They watched from the mouth of an alley as Virginia Parkins went from store to store. Her last stop, Harbinson's General Mercantile, coincided with the arrival of Smoke in his hands. Brandon Kelso paid scant attention to the strangers and the confrontation with the mayor. Intent on his prey, he had eyes only for Jenny Parkins. When she came out of the general store, her arms filled with packages, Brandon and his two loutish friends stepped out onto the boardwalk and formed a semicircle around her.
Sorry you tried to make a fool out of me now, you dried-up sow.
I never tried to make a fool of you, Brandon. You do quite well at that all by yourself. Now please, get out of my way.
You ain't going nowhere, you bitch. Not until we say you can. What a sorry waste of a woman you are. Never had a man, have you?
You vulgar gutter snipe! That is none of your business.
Yep, you ain't never had a man. Bet you're a shriveled prune. You know what I mean?
You filthy animal! Your father will hear of this!
He stepped off the boardwalk and began to kick and stomp the purchases. Paper bags burst to spray flour and salt. Eggs splattered and ran yellow out into the dust to be absorbed. Three onions went flying.
Someone please help!
By that time, three drunken pieces of human debris had come out of the Sorry Place saloon to see what was going on. Brandon, carried away by his success so far and seeking to impress the saddle tramps, spun back on one boot heel and snarled as he raised a hand as though to strike her.
Shut up, you bitch!
At that moment, Smoke Jensen stepped out onto the street. He instantly took in the tableau before him. His cold, gold-brown gaze fixed on Jenny as she cringed back and raised a hand defensively. Aroused by her helplessness, Brandon and his sidekicks took two quick steps toward her, the destruction of her groceries forgotten. They closed around her, their hands raised again.
Someone please help!
Brandon brought up his ham hand to strike her in the face. Suddenly, an iron hard grip encircled Brandon's waist. At once, the hand of the punk he held in his grasp turned snowy, then began to swell and flush a dark red.
Let go! Let go of me!
Smoke Jensen yanked him around and drove a hard right fist into the pouting lips of Brandon Kelso.
Leave if you don't want to hurt for a long time. Leave town if you don't want to stay here forever, out on the hill above us.
Who do you think you are?
Oh, I know who I am.
Just who's that?
Well, folks call me Smoke Jensen. I'm the new sheriff in Muddy Gap.
Well, Peckerwood, I don't give a shit the hell who you are.
Smoke Jensen squared off and met him with a solid left-right combination that rocked Brandon's head back. Brandon let go a wide looping right, which Smoke blocked easily. Then, the mountain man stepped in and began a snare drum tattoo on the soft, pulpy flesh of his opponent.
Wall, don't just stand there. Jump in and help me!
Young Danny Collins held back while Willie Finch, always in the sway of Brandon Kelso, filled with false bravado, leaped forward to join the fray. Less than a second later, he began to regret it. The flat of Smoke's boot sole caught Willie in the belly. Its force drove the boy back, doubled over, cheeks puffed out by the force of the wind knocked from him. Thin, green, bitter gorge rose up from his throat and spilled onto his shirt. Darkness danced before his eyes. Smoke turned back to young Kelso. Grinning, he made inviting gestures to draw the lout in closer.
Come on! You want more, don't you?
You bet your butt, mister. I ain't afraid of you.
You ought to be.
Oh, yeah? What for?
You just don't get it, do you? I've killed 100 better men than you'll ever grow up to be. Now get out of here, you little turd, before I break something serious.
Like hell!
By then, Willie Finch had recovered his courage and leaped on Smoke's back.
I got him, Brandon! I got him good!
Danny Collins found his nerve and waded in too. He landed two good blows to Smoke's side and belly. Then, Brandon was there. Before the leader of this collection of misfits could swing, he received one of Smoke's kicks. This one, square in the crotch. With a quick shrug, Smoke broke Willie's hold and flung the thin boy away to slam into the front of the barber shop. Smoke turned at once to make a quick end of Danny Collins.
Oh, lordy, 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 no!
Smoke gave his attention to Brandon Kelso then. Smoke put a hard hand on one shoulder and spun Brandon Kelso to face him.
The lady is waiting for an apology.
No way I'll do that.
You want more then?
No, man. But I ain't gonna apologize.
Smoke took Brandon's nose between his left index and middle finger and squeezed.
Oh, sweet baby Jesus. Oh, it hurts. It hurts.
With a good yank, he brought the lout along with him to where Virginia Parkins stood, hands over her eyes. Smoke politely tipped his hat.
Ma'am, this pitiful piece of human garbage has something to say to you.
No, I... Yes, sure, sorry we busted up your stuff, Miss Pockets.
And you'll pay for the replacements, right?
Yes, I will.
Dig it out, then.
Brandon Kelso was fighting back tears as he reached into his pocket. He brought out a fistful of coins. Smoke looked up at Virginia Parkins and then cut his eyes to her ruined purchases.
How much did that cost you, ma'am?
$1.25.
Smoke plucked the proper amount from Brandon's open hand. He handed it to Jenny, then turned Brandon by the nose and planted a boot across the junior thug's butt. Sent him on his way. Smoke returned to the boardwalk and looked up to see the mayor standing, open-mouthed, staring at him. Smoke reached out his hand.
Well, Mr. Mayor, I think I'll take that badge you offered. Looks like you have a need here, right enough.
Thank you, Mr. Jensen. Thank you from the bottom of my heart. But what about your herd?
Jerry, we take the herd on for a few days. I'll catch up before the end of the week.
Right, boss. Say... You do good work, Smoke.
Mayor Norton led the way to the sheriff's office and jail. There, he showed Smoke around and further explained the situation in Muddy Gap. In particular, he appraised Smoke of the names of the local boys he had taken down a notch minutes earlier. While they talked, Boyne Kelso stormed into the room.
Mayor, I demand that the man who beat up my son and robbed him be arrested at once.
His eyes cut from Norton to Smoke, noted the badge, and jabbed a long finger at him.
Well, what are you waiting for? If you're the new lawman I've heard about, you had better start earning your keep. I want that saddlebum arrested and jailed.
I'm afraid that's impossible. You see, I'm that saddlebum.
Lester, I can't believe you hired a thief to replace Sheriff Hutchins.
I haven't. This is Smoke Jensen. He's a former deputy U.S. Marshal. And your boy was tormenting Miss Jenny.
I don't believe it. Brandon is a good boy. He would never do such a thing.
You'd better believe it, Mr. Kelso. He and two other loafs assaulted the school teacher, took her packages from her, and destroyed the contents. When your brat made to strike her, I intervened. The money I took was to replace what he destroyed.
You can't do this. I'm Boyne Kelso, and my son is my son.
Are you implying that you, too, assault women and ravage their property?
What impudence! I'm warning you!
Smoke moved like a striking rattler. He crossed the short space between himself and Kelso with two strides and took the outraged man by the front of his shirt.
No, Mr. Kelso, I'm warning you. If that misbegotten piece of garbage you call your son so much as spits on the boardwalk, I'll cold cock him with my colt and drag him to jail. From here on, he and you will be on the best possible behavior. Now get out of here and let me do my job.